Robin Ayub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another episode. And today we are recording episode 156, and it's been what a lovely ride since 2023 when I started the channel. I can't believe I'm saying I've recorded 156 episodes so far. Where did the time go? My guest of honor today is Andre Huberger, and Andre joins me from Language Scientific, and we'll talk a little bit about what Andre does and what the company does as well today. The objective for me is to get to know Andres a little bit and get to know what he does and the company does. As we say on this story, on this channel, Andres, is everybody's got a story. And I can't wait to hear, the audience can't wait to hear your story. I think you and I talked a little about your story a little earlier when we prepped for the call, but For the audience who don't know you, what is your story?
My story is I was born and raised in Switzerland, came to the US for college and stuck around essentially, and landed in the translation business by pure accident. It didn't even occur to me back in the 80s or whenever it was that such a thing even existed. But I kind of got stuck and saw how the industry has evolved over those decades. Today, I run sales and marketing for Language Scientific. And our focus is primarily on pharmaceutical and medical device companies, helping them with their multilingual regulatory and clinical challenges. And one of the things that's been fascinating to me over the past three-ish years is just how the role of AI has fundamentally changed and is still changing our business in ways that, again, when I started, I couldn't even anticipate or fathom. So that's been really, really interesting. And it's been great to see our team really rising to the challenge. And we have some unique challenges, again, because of the focus that we have, regulatory, clinical affairs professionals, and life science companies. They have unique needs and unique constraints as well. So dealing with that, staying on top of evolving regulations has been a lot of fun, actually.
So, you know, one of the obvious thing, Andres, when I go on your LinkedIn profile, you're always hiring salespeople. So what is the story on that one? You're always hiring, or what's going on?
Well, it's an evergreen notification. You know, qualified salespeople are hard to find.
Dime a dozen nowadays, right?
Well, there are a dime a dozen, but the good ones aren't.
That's right.
The good ones aren't. But even there, you know, speaking of AI, it's interesting how AI is making inroads into that profession as well.
You mean the selling profession, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it'll be fascinating to see what that looks like a year, let alone 2 years down the road.
I mean, we're talking a lot about the top of the funnel assistants right now using AI.
Yeah. Yeah.
From a selling perspective. And there's a lot of tools allowing individuals to do many things now that you had to do them manually, or you had to hire more people.
Exactly. And, you know, it's I find the whole AI topic fascinating from the perspective of how uneven its application is. And unfortunately for us, translation and language services in general are mm-hmm. sort of at the very top of the use cases for
Absolutely. AI. Absolutely.
Where it works. Just works.
Yeah. Now, I run, and funny you say that, because we were just talking about it this morning. I do every Friday, we do a virtual AI exchange networking event. It takes place at 9 a.m. in the morning. And everybody was talking about this particular one, like the variety of ways AI is being deployed, where is being more impactful than other places. You know, what's the ROI on deploying AI, and how real are these benefits, and what are the applications? Yep. There's a lot of unanswered. Yeah. Questions, I believe, in the market right now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it's interesting. It goes beyond language services. I heard a story yesterday on the radio that looked at somebody did a research study on how AI is impacting teenage summer jobs. Totally random. Never would have thought of that. But so according to this study, they predict that within 5 years, there will be 27% fewer job opportunities for teenagers, summer jobs, essentially, because AI is taking over cashier jobs. They're taking over, you know, selling in a store because of kiosks. They're taking over even cooking stations.
That's right.
It's fascinating.
It's funny when you say that, because I was talking to a company here in the area, Jet Robotics, I think it's called. And what they did is they're marrying AI with robotics to eliminate, okay, or you know, some of their customers, example, they will come in and will say, we need a robot that lifts one piece of wood, put it on a conveyor belt. That used to be done by a person.
So the robot
now with the right programming can lift the board, put it on a conveyor belt, and you don't need that person.
Yeah. And it's also interesting in those types of industrial settings, you can validate the technology and the AI, right?
You can run it. Tangible, it's right there.
Yeah, exactly. Either the piece of wood is in the right place or it's not. And you do that 1,000 times and okay. But what's interesting in the translation space is that is still very opaque, let's just say. And clients struggle with, how do I trust AI generated translations? How do I know reliably? And again, this is in our space of particular importance because I'm putting a regulatory submission together for a clinical trial or a clinical trial report or whatever. There's a mistake in there. I got to go all the way back to the beginning of this process and going to spend hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars to redo this work. So the trust factor is both critically important and hasn't been solved.
Is this different though, Andres, from any other technology adoption that we went through our lifetime? You and I are pretty much the same age. I remember days when, you know, when somebody would walk in and say, you know, I'm going to give you this little plastic card. You're going to put it into a box and it's going to give you money. And people will freak out over that.
Yeah.
And it took us a while, but society, communities, and humanity came around. And now we can't live without the plastic card.
Yeah,
actually, we're trying to get rid of everything monetary nowadays that's hard currency, right?
And you're absolutely correct. I mean, we're still we're in the early stages of this, right? So this will be solved. There's no question about it. Until we get there, though, there are a lot of our clients who are explicitly saying, do not use AI on our translation work. We cannot take the risk. So one of the areas where we've been spending a lot of time and focus on is, how do we bridge that gap? How do we bridge that known reliability gap? And it's not easy. It's not straightforward.
No, because translation, as we mentioned earlier, comparison to industrial application, translation is very gray area. You know, the quality or the consumer, whoever the consumer is, billions of consumers of translation content, can each one of those decide what's acceptable, what is not acceptable?
Absolutely. That's exactly right.
When you're designing a chair or a desk, there's dimensions, there's weight, there's fit, there's color. In translation, none of that apply.
Well, and different things apply. So we're working with one company, fascinating. They're developing AI-based training modules for salespeople. And so, fascinating thing applies. How do you define quality? So let's say you want to sell, you're selling pharmaceuticals to doctors, right? You're one of those sales reps that goes from hospital to hospital. Okay, how do you define the quality of that interaction? Okay, it's got to be correct use of language. Let's say if I'm in Japan, I got to use the right language. I got to use the right tone. As a sales rep, am I female or am I male? You know, what voice applies? How do I approach a doctor in Japan? How is that different from how I would address a doctor in England? You know, so quality takes on a very nuanced form and factor here, where it goes really beyond, it's language at the core, clearly, but it goes beyond that. And that's fascinating, bringing the whole cultural and localization aspect to it as well.
So in your opinion, like Andres, like in what you're seeing right now from the company you work for, Language Scientific, what are you convinced that it is true, and in life sciences specifically, and what most buyers still misunderstand? Is it that whole topic of technology still they don't understand it?
I think they understand it. So one of the fascinating things that we find is that, as I mentioned, a good number of our clients explicitly say, do not use AI in translation. And those same companies will gladly say, we use AI every day for other parts of their business, right? Whether it's who knows what. So it's not that they're anti-technologists, that they're Luddites or anything like that. The other fascinating thing that we find, a lot of those same clients are happy to say, yeah, we use like Google Translate. You know, I got an email from France or something like that. I'll feed it into Google Translate to see what it says. So again, they're not fundamentally averse to using technology. It is because of this the big risk factors that exist in that space.
Yeah.
And what's always curious to me is, you know, the risk factors really, they're a little different, but they're the same as with human translations, right? Quality has always been subjective. It has always been, this person thinks it's a great translation, this person hates it and wants to rewrite the whole thing just because it's Wednesday and I'm not having a good
day.
That's right. So it's never been really figured out. And even the traditional translation quality metrics that people were building methodologies around and reporting on as if it was carved in stone by Moses kind of thing, it was all just made up, essentially.
That's right. You know, it just reminded me, years ago, I came to the industry by accident, similar to what you did. And I was working for this company out of a small province in New Brunswick in Canada. And you mentioned earlier, like, because it's Wednesday, we got to rewrite everything. So this individual was in charge of marking or revising other people's work. Work has been done. Then we send it to that individual. It comes back all marked red. They hate the work. And many, many translators, these are translators, they're not satisfactory to her. So the boss, the owner of the company, got mad one time. So he goes to the system, picks up a document who's translated by that individual himself, and then takes it back to her and say, would you mind revising this one? It came back all red. But that individual, who's the actual one who did the work.
Yep. That
happened to be Wednesday all the time there.
That's right. You know, and so now you don't have an additional challenge with these generative AI systems is there's no predictability to what it'll spit out, right? We just did a test internally a few days ago where two of us were both on ChatGPT or Gemini or whatever we used and fed it the same questions and got partially different answers back. Not totally different, but partially different. And I think that's when it comes to translation is also hard. Yes, you can leverage translation memories, you can leverage glossaries, you know, all of that stuff. But the differences in what you get back are random or not discernible by humans anyway. It all looks good. It reads appropriate. And you're much more likely to miss the one sentence or the one paragraph or the three words somewhere that don't belong in there. You know, the whole hallucination thing where it's just the algorithm did something wrong. And it might have been correct the last time. The next time it's incorrect.
That's right.
It's
in your, this is very well known fact about AI. You need to really, if you want to use it, you need to really take your time, train it. Like I call it like having a young teenager and you're trying to teach them the way of the world kind of thing. You got to always keep instructing and validating the instruction and teaching. It's like having a little kid, literally. A lot of people, what they do generally is they use the easy way out. Basically, they write a very short prompt and expect, you know, a solid, consistent answer all the time, which doesn't work. You got to give a boundary. You got to teach it what needs to be done. Now, one of the things that I always talk about here is there's still people out there, I think, and I don't know if you agree with this statement, there are some leaders in not necessarily maybe in the language industry, I don't know, but there are some leaders I talk to, you sense that they're pretty much lying to themselves when it comes to either technology or the way the world is going when it comes to translation. Yeah. I don't know if they are oblivious or they have their own bubble or what's going on. Do you feel that way?
I do. And I think there's a fine line there somewhere, right? On one hand, you want to be on the forefront of new technology, of new developments, of innovations. So I get that. On the other hand, I think what we've certainly found is that in the context of talking to clients, right, it also very much depends on the client's perspective on that. How do they view the use of technology in general and AI specifically? And thinking of one of our clients specifically, they're probably the most leading edge AI company that I've come across. Like that's the lens they see the world through completely. And no, in translation, no way. You're not using that. And so it's not a black and white answer. And I think you need to calibrate the messaging and in your own head too, right? Like, how do I think about the use of AI? Is it useful, appropriate even in a lot of cases? Absolutely. Is it the end all be all? No, it's not. So we actually have a term for this. We call it fit for use. Again, depending on what the client needs, we build the process to give them exactly what they need. So if somebody needs a series of patient interactions translated, they probably don't need the gold standard of translation processes, right? They need to know, they need to be able to effectively communicate with patients. On the other hand, again, clinical research submission, regulatory submission, they do need the gold standard of translation processes, and they need a fully human process. So it's not AI generated, it's not human in the loop type of thing. No, it's human generated from A to Z. And then the third challenge, I think, also is, and this to me is one of the dangers of going full in on the AI bubble, let's just say, things are changing so quickly. So what you're investing so much time and potentially money into today, it could be outdated in 18 months. You know, it just, nobody knows where this thing is. Or, sorry, speaking for myself, I don't know where this thing is going. So, and I'm not going to put everything, you know, in one box and put the whole business on it. So it's, I guess translation has always been a little bit like that, but you know, there's always been technology advances. Back when OCR, optical character recognition, was a big innovation, right?
I know.
How do you trust that? How can a machine do this for you? What safeguards do we build in? And now it's whatever, how many years later, and it's just there. It exists. You still have to check it. You've got to have some process around it, but it's an integral part of translation processes.
Yeah. Now, you've been, and I just noticed that on your LinkedIn profile, which is sort of interesting because I've never seen this before, is that you've held an operational role before you crossed the chasm into a sales role.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
I mean, I remember the conversation, actually. That was way back in the day. Somebody, the president of the company said, "Hey, have you thought about doing this? I think you'd be great at it." And I remember being totally taken aback. And it's like, what are you talking about? I know nothing about any of this stuff. but decided to give it a try, was given the chance to give it a try, and found I liked it. And I think part of, and we still do that at Language Scientific as well. The best salespeople have an operational background, because selling translation services, while there is the sales aspect to it, clearly, you know, you got to have the sales processes in place. But our clients, at least, they don't want to be sold to. They want to have the problem of translation solved for them.
Yeah, make it go away.
Make it go away, exactly. Because nobody wants to do translation. They have to.
That's right.
So how can you solve this for me? And who better to do that than somebody who knows the intricacies of project management, maybe of translation technology, of vendor management even, and can speak to that eloquently. And we just did this like 6 months ago, transferred somebody with an operations background into sales. It's fascinating to watch him.
Do they do better or equal to the sales people?
They certainly ramp up faster. There's no question about it. And he's a unique individual in that he's very personable and, again, knowledgeable about the business. So he doesn't come across as a salesperson, which is ideal. As soon as he notices, like, I'm speaking to you and I see a picture of a dog in the background, or the dog walks past, or whatever, what kind of cute dog? You know, they'll start talking about dogs.
That's right.
You know, and so it's I think, easy for him to establish rapport, establish relationships, and establish trust, going back to that. Back in the day, it was hard to find good salespeople with translation experience. There just weren't many in the translation space. That has changed. There are more now.
Yeah.
But really good ones, and again, that's why that evergreen banner is on LinkedIn.
You're always looking for that, you know, you got to kiss many frogs to find the prince. Is that how it works?
That's correct. That's correct. That's right. That's right. And I think the other interesting thing that was very different, but it's the internationalization of the translation space, where,
right,
you know, now it is 100%, if not expected, then accepted, that I work with somebody in Argentina. My sales rep is based out of the UK. So it's much more global in nature than it used to be.
Definitely, I've noticed in the past few years that the transition industry has taken on a lot more global role. And I do believe private equity firms has something to do with that in terms of driving the investment that they put into the language industry in general to the next level of marketing, sales, penetration of new countries, new territories, etc.
Makes sense. I mean, there's also, we're not there yet, but at some point there's a finite size to the translation industry, right? So the whole, how do I grow within a, at least slow, how do I grow the business within a slow growing industry environment? And so geographic expansion definitely is part of that story.
That's right. And I don't believe, like, I don't know which camp you're in, but in general, the industry is not an infinite growth trajectory.
Exactly.
I don't believe that. Because at some point when technology married with the right professional beside technology, because you got to try to line it up and balance it as much as you can, technology, human, etc. And as time goes on, you got to be able to either insert the human into the appropriate process where it needs to be inserted, and or take them out where you need to take them out. And that has to be agile. It cannot be boxed in. So yep. This will change over time. But yep. I do believe as we continue marrying technology and human in the process of producing translation, the growth of the industry will come into a point where it plateaus. It's sort of like the you know, the legal industry, right? So it's not like the legal industry on a trajectory. I need 20,000 lawyers in yep. Canada every year. That's not going
to happen. That's not going to happen, right? Yeah, no, I totally agree with that viewpoint. And that's okay. I mean, that's quite honestly a good thing. If I think back to 20 years ago, what clients spent on a translation, on a given translation for an operating manual or something like that, or an instruction for use document of any size, it was massive. It was massive dollars because so much of it was manual work. And nowadays, it's so much more productive, efficient, and less expensive. The same work gets done of the same quality. So yeah, that's and I think this is the other thing that where the change is already happening. There's no more linguists coming into the industry, or very few of them anyway. I have a colleague and friend who went to translation school in France, and she has a friend there who teaches there still. And she said, a class of mine used to be 200 students, call it 10, 15 years ago. Now it's 30, because the linguists are at the receiving end of all of this.
Well, I mean, they're more very well informed, these students, right? So when they select which degree right. they want to go into, and they read the right. do a little bit of research, first thing is going to pop out, you know, guess what? AI is going to take away your job. So why are you going to invest in it? Unless right. you're investing in it because I want to learn a new language, or I want to do yeah. something better. Yeah, that becomes a bourgeois choice.
That's right. And also, there will always be a need for specialized linguists.
For sure.
For specialized roles within the translation space. So it's not totally going to go away. The next shoe that will drop, in my opinion anyway, is going to be interpreting, where you know, that becomes AI-driven. Incredible how voice technology, AI-driven voice technology, has evolved, advanced, just in the last 12 months even. Because we look at that regularly. We don't do a lot of interpretation, but we do some. And that's 12 months from now, if I were a betting man, I would say AI is good enough in the main languages. Spanish, certainly.
Of course. Now, on the life sciences side, how do you deal with risk, and how do you categorize the content in life sciences? You must have some risk factors in various content types. So
yeah.
Can you speak to that a little bit, Anders?
Yeah. I mean, we call that fit for use. So we try and really understand, what is this document? Who's the user at the end of the day of this? Is this internal communication? Is it staff training? Is it regulatory submission? Is it, you know, one of the dirty secrets of medical translation space is these IFUs, the instruction for use documents, that need to accompany every medical device that gets sold, certainly in Europe, in the European languages. And companies spend an inordinate amount of time and money on producing and maintaining and updating these documents. Nobody reads them. It's a regulatory requirement
And is that an exercise of checking the box kind of thing? Or
Yeah, exactly. And if you think about it, it makes sense that nobody used to. Okay, if I get a knee replacement, let's just say, do I want the surgeon to be going, okay, now I got to look on page 53. How do I put this thing in? No, I don't want that.
You're not selecting that surgeon, God forbid.
Exactly. I want the person to know what to do with this device. But it's a regulatory requirement. You can't sell in Europe without that. It's the same in the US. I'm not singling out Europe. It's the same in most jurisdictions. But so it's the risk factor there is an interesting one because, again, on one hand, nobody reads this stuff, literally. On the other hand, there have been instances where products had to be recalled because of an error in the documentation or in some rarer instance because of a mistake that a surgeon did. And that gets real expensive if you have to recall medical devices, especially implants like, you know, a replacement knee. How do you deal with that? So the risk is often reputational and monetary and less, it's really less safety. That would have to be an egregious error for that to raise it. And, you know, we deal with the financial risk, of course, contractually, you know, like every translation company, and the reputational risk, that's real for us as well as our clients. You know, if you have even, you know, it has nothing to do with translation, but Johnson & Johnson with their Tylenol scare 15, 20 years ago, you know, that does real damage. And if that involved translation, you know, that relationship would be over. You can kiss that goodbye. So we spend a good amount of time assessing risk, especially at the beginning of a client relationship, where we really try to understand how do we think about this for this client, and then how do we build processes around it to minimize the risks, to the extent possible, also share the risk with the client. They review the documentation, the translations, they sign off on it. But at the end of the day, it's again, one big translation mistake, that relationship is over.
Yeah, that's right. It becomes very costly, right, Andre? It becomes that's costly right. For both the provider and
exactly.
And the manufacturer or the incumbent. Now, one of the, because you have a, you know, you're very cognizant of the risk. And that, by the way, that risk and you, the way you described it, there is a lot of obligations in manufacturer. It doesn't matter what sector you're in for translation, even though let's example, for instance, if you're a car manufacturer on the assembly line, there are in the United States right now, you cannot let that car off the assembly line unless there is a manual. Now it's all digital right. Nowadays. Inside sure. Of the car that is translated. And a lot of times they will hold the traffic until the manual is inside of the cars.
Yeah.
You know, there, it's various places, but I guess when you're talking about people's lives impacted, specifically in the medical sector, it becomes a little bit more, Now, one of the things is when we talk about the medical sector is specifically for translation is quality control. Walk me through your quality control chain and where do most providers perhaps, I mean, you got to, not ignore, you got to probably keep it in the back of the radar here is the price, which is, you know, a lot of competition out there. Everybody's claiming something because
yep.
Money's becoming scarce, revenue's becoming yep. Scarce. So everybody's getting hungry out there, right? So, and that pushes certain behavior in a variety of industry leaders and providers. So what does quality means to you and how do you control it?
Yeah, going back to the fit for purpose concept, part of the reason to understand what is the client needing from us is exactly that, which means what quality process do we put in place? And that differs also from project to project type. So for example, for a linguistic validation process, you know, you have back translation, you have a reconciliation, you possibly have cognitive debriefing, and all of those steps are required, in fact. And they're also well established. There's not much to figure out there. On the flip side of that, we literally had a conversation on Monday with a client who said, I know this sounds crazy, but I have a million words in Chinese that I need in English for a regulatory submission by next Monday in 7 days. And they were realistic in their assessment that it was crazy. But it was interesting that they spoke to a number of translation companies, because again, they knew the challenge of it. And at the end of the day, they said, everybody told us we were crazy, except for Language Scientific. You really walked us through, here are the possibilities, and here are the trade-offs with regards to quality. I think that's the most important thing, in my opinion, is obviously everybody can take shortcuts. You can skip steps. You can deploy machine translation, AI generated translations, whatever. But you need to work with the client on that. So that, again, it's also a shared risk, again, going back to that concept, where it's not just then they come back a month later and say, holy moly, what did you give to us here for $200,000? This is crap. Well, no, actually, remember when we talked about that and we said, here's the process we're going to deploy and you needed it within 7 days? And that's where, remember? So that avoids that conversation from coming up. The harder situations are when somebody says, I need 1 million words translated in a week, but you can't take any shortcuts. You need to go through the whole process. Then it becomes impossible.
Yeah.
It's the old, you can have
the genie, Andre.
That's exactly right. You can have any of the three, you know, time, quality, price. Pick two.
Now, I know you're well tuned into the industry, etc. But I think there are, and I just me assessing this because I've been on the receiving end of it many times now. I'm no longer inside mm-hmm. of it, but I'm looking at it from the outside in. It hasn't been that long, you know, since I left my last job. It was September.
Okay.
The idea is there's a lot of vendors out there. They're doing a lot of what I call theater around many things, you know, just to get the order. Right? And there are few of those vendors out there, I call them vendor, you know, translation service provider, language service providers, that they are really authentic and sitting down with the customer and explaining what's possible. And the customer, a lot of times, they take the honesty conversation at a very good, they receive it very positively, versus that whole theater around, you know, no, don't worry, Mr. Customer, million words for tomorrow morning, don't worry about it. I'll get that for you done, no problem. What do you think of that?
I think that is absolutely true. And it's actually interesting. We're having a lot of conversations about this. We're very much in the former camp, right? Where we really want to understand the client's needs. We want to be helpful. We want to solve complex problems for them, right? That involves conversations. Over the past, it's really been recent, over the past 9 months, maybe, we've seen a stark increase in the number of prospects. It's not customers, prospects, who say, no, I don't want to talk to you. Just give me a price. Just, you know, just give me some information. Give me a price. I don't want to get on a phone call with you. And that, I think, is driven in part by the number of translation service providers who do exactly that. They just, oh, you need a quote? Here it is. I don't need to talk to you. But look at all the beautiful stuff we can do for you. Look at this fancy brochure. Look at, our website and this, whatever it is, you know. But there is theater there, and there is the downgrading of expectations on the client side, where, as I said before, fundamentally, nobody wants to do translation. Nobody wants to buy translation services. They have to for whatever reason. But with the increase in competition, and quite honestly, also with the increase in popularity for tools like Google Translate, I can just go online and put in my text and it comes back. Do I know if it's accurate? No. Do I care? Maybe also no, right? So it becomes much more commoditized even than the business used to be.
That's right.
So it's and AI will further that even more.
Yeah.
So we have clients, they have their own instance. They run their own instances of a DeepL, for example, or something like that. So why do I need a translation company?
That's right. Now, when, you know, and this is the thing too, because I don't know how much you give visibility to the factory floor for your customers.
Yep. As little as possible.
Yeah. So because a lot of times what ends up happening is the more detail you give out, the more scrutiny on that process. But some customers, they want to see, you know, they want to know how exactly you're going to perform each step.
Yes.
And this is where, you know, overpromise and underdeliver, or underdeliver and overpromise.
Yeah.
Depends on the philosophy, how you see these things going. But I've seen both of them. I've seen like underpromise, overdeliver, which seems to resonate a little bit more versus overpromise and underdeliver. How much visibility do you think your customers are asking for right now? Because you mentioned earlier, like they're telling you not to use AI. So obviously they know the tools.
Right. Exactly. No, exactly. And I think the short answer is it depends. And one big factor on what it depends on is the experience level of the client. Like they've been running large translation programs for the past 20 years. They have one set of expectations in terms of wanting to know, pull the curtain back, show me what you're doing. The less experienced that a client and the client contact in particular is, the less that they don't know what to ask. Again, they don't know, they don't want to do translation, so they don't care. Just get it done. Make this problem go away for me. Another interesting thing compared to, again, 20 years ago maybe or so, I see a lot more ex-translation company employees working on the client side, where they're running the translation program, the translation department, the language department for a given client. And sometimes those are the best clients to have, and sometimes they're the worst clients to have because they know what questions to ask. And, you know, they focus on, but what about this step? How are you doing? Why is it here and not here? You know, whatever, what their background informed them of. And so it can become...
But they were hired for there, Andre.
I know, exactly. I get it. But that can be exhausting. But quite honestly, from my perspective, the more informed a client is, the better. I love nothing more than having clients who ask detailed, intelligent questions, want background information, as long as they know what to do with our responses, right? Where it's not just, you've seen this in the past too. Like we get these RFPs or RFIs. Shoot, the amazing, the length of the materials that they're requesting. And they're requesting this from, let's say, 10 different providers. I always ask, what are they going to do with the responses? Who's evaluating the detail from company A to the details from company B, et cetera? What are they doing with that? So,
do you think it's a make work project and the only interest is the last page, which is the price page?
It's Friday afternoon, I think,
recording this. We're doing three calls right.
That thought crosses my mind more often than I would like it to. That's right. And, you know, on both ends, I mean, certainly makes work for us. But I also think procurement people look good, right? They say, look at this 25-page RFP I put together and made 12 different companies fill out and respond to. And then,
So let's talk a little bit about the future here. I know you've commented on this in the past. In terms of clinical research, what are the use cases that you're most excited about coming up here soon? I think I've heard you talk about this before.
So it's clinical research in general is not AI friendly today. Around the edges, there's some AI use just in general, and not just translation, but, you know, medical writing is a big piece there. Again, there's a lot that hinges on that. However, that is also an evolving field. So last year, the EU AI Act came into effect, and that is a gradual rollout over some amount of time and puts some guardrails around the use of AI. FDA just earlier this week also started providing some guidance around the use of AI. And so my view is that as these, they're not regulations necessarily, but as these guardrails become more clearly defined and actionable by pharmaceutical companies in this case, AI acceptance and use will increase significantly. Clinical research is no different from the IFUs that I taught. Well, no, it is different. Oh, I'm sorry. But what is not different is that companies spend a large amount of money on clinical research. Translation is part of that. It's not all of it. But anything that can be done to reliably reduce the expense of that undertaking will be embraced as quickly and as completely as possible by pharma companies. And again, I think it's a matter of, it's not if, it is when this is coming.
So you see that, right, Andre?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what would be materially different in life sciences language services by, let's say, 2028? Is that what you're aiming at? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I don't know if it's 2028 or if it's 2035, right? I don't know. But I think we are, I can only speak for ourselves. We are investing a lot of time and attention and money ultimately into staying on top of AI developments, testing and retesting tools, talking with our clients about it, what their experiences, their risk appetite is for that. So I am convinced that, again, at that future time and place and time and point in time, there will be a time when if you're a translation provider and you don't fully embrace AI, and not just embrace it, but can deploy it, right, with and for your clients, you're either going away or you're relegated to very niche services where you can make a case for humans only or limited technology use or whatever. But a general life sciences translation company that doesn't embrace AI isn't going to exist at that time.
It's not going to stick around.
Yeah, that's I don't see it. I mean, and in the meantime, it's expensive and it's frustrating also for us. It's not just a one-time testing of a tool. 6 months is a lifetime right now. You got to go back and say, what has changed in the last 6 months?
Yeah.
Does it still do what we found last time around when we looked at it? Look, no, now it's better in this area. This hasn't changed. This has gotten worse, you know, whatever. But so it's really it's an ongoing effort. Not everybody is willing or able to do that in our space.
So what is the, in your opinion, now we've got a lot of people listening to this, and I'm surprised how many people listen to the podcast, to be honest with you. When I started this thing, I was hoping like for a few people listening to the show. Now I've got like 1,200 downloads per day and 2.5 million views around the world. I'm really awesome. Happy about this. But what if some buyers, some procurement people are listening into this conversation right now, mm-hmm. and you have a wishful thinking that you would like to give them, you know, I've got a few wishes. Christmas, I know, just passed, but maybe for next Christmas. What is the one thing you wish every buyer would implement immediately?
I have a clear answer to that. But taking it's never going to change that they're going to take translation seriously or, you know, on the same level as legal services or other professional mm-hmm. services, right? I get that.
Right.
And it can also be true that it could be treated as a more strategic endeavor than it is today. For so many clients and prospects, companies in general, it's a purely transactional thing. And I understand that if you have 3 translations once a year kind of thing, okay, it is in fact transactional. But even a lot of clients with ongoing, regular, and growing translation needs rarely view it as anything other than a transactional business relationship. They don't give it the time of day. It's and everybody's busy. I get it, right? So, and there's bigger priorities. You got to look at where is my time best spent. I get it all. But that would be the one wish I had, because while we do our best to be proactive in supporting our clients, making mm-hmm. suggestions, giving feedback, giving input, there is so much we can assist clients with, that we can help them with, that we could improve on their behalf mm-hmm. if only they cared for us to do that.
Yeah,
and the reality is few of them do. And even large clients, this is not, it's not about a particular industry. It's not about a particular size or type of company. It's just few people do.
Now, you know, I've got to tell you a couple of anecdotes. You probably have many of them, but the one that really still sticks in my mind over the years is reading this RFP one time, and there's a big paragraph on it, how much, you know, the translator needs to wear hard hats when they're doing the work. Apparently, the procurement person took that template from, I don't know, buying construction material somewhere.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And just left that paragraph in. Hard hats required. And it's like the title of the paragraph. And another one recently, not too long ago, it was lost opportunity. Guess why? Because we did not include a fax number in the response.
Oh, man.
I was just like,
oh, man.
What is this?
Oh.
It's crazy.
That is crazy.
Yeah, and you know, I know, just like, let's close on a positive note. Can you talk about a deal that you won that looked pretty much impossible, but you turned around and you said, hey, we locked it?
It's the sales training thing that I mentioned earlier. Actually, it's interesting and really in the context of they use AI to generate the sales training, the role playing type of thing. Then they use AI to quality check this text. And then they use AI to translate it. And what they needed from us was a way to say, how can we trust this translation at the end of all these AI steps? So we were able to build a methodology for them that would allow them to do that and deploy that at scale across languages. And that was thrilled that we had the opportunity to work with them on. It goes to the heart of what we do, again, solving these complex problems that are tangentially related to language services, but extend far beyond that. And those are the opportunities, those are the clients who I love working with. Something out of the box, something new, something different. And that's not to minimize the joy we get from working with other clients as well. But it's a nice way to break up, you know, your work week. It's a nice way to stay at the forefront of what's happening in the space. And it's nice to learn new things, even at my age.
Great. Now, as we wrap it up here, what are you hoping this podcast will do for you, for Language Scientific, or the listeners who are listening? And what would you like for them to do after listening to this conversation?
Call 1-800-LANGUAGE-SCIENTIFIC and buy a lot of translation services.
That's the easy way out.
I think you've touched on this. I've touched on this a little bit. It's such a quickly evolving space that, and one of the things I admire about what you're doing is there have been attempts in the past to do podcasts about translations and localization and things like that. Very few succeed at doing that over the long term. You know, somebody puts out 6 episodes and then runs out of steam because it's not easy to produce them. It's not easy to make them meaningful. You got to put out a good product in order to do that. So I think that's where you stand out and really provide listeners with, okay, maybe this isn't 100% relevant to what I'm doing, but that's a half hour well spent listening to it. And nothing is more frustrated than when I sit through a webinar and, man, I just spent 60 minutes I will never get back. That's just it's a waste of everybody's time.
Absolutely.
So that's what I hope, that there's some value, a nugget in here that is helpful to somebody.
And you know what? Over the years, I've been doing this 2.5 years now. Every episode I put out there, I get good compliments on the episode from everybody commenting on the conversational style of the podcast and the way the conversation is flowing. It's not an interrogation. It is not a journalist versus subject talking to, trying to investigate each other. That's not what it is about. It's just two guys in this case, you know, over a coffee somewhere and having a conversation about something. And people tell me that they can follow it with ease. I couldn't believe it. Like, I had a comment back. Somebody told me, like, I listened to your podcast at the gym. I said, are you kidding me? At the gym? I need hard rock music, man, to keep me moving.
That's quite a compliment. That's quite the compliment.
Well, if you can take us with you to the gym, fine. You know, whatever suits your need, I'm happy with
that's
that.
That's correct.
And the nuggets that you talked about, that's exactly what people are talking about. They listen to it with ease, but they take notes of some of the nuggets that came through, which is, I'm appreciative of your time with me today, Anders. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate it as well. A pleasure.
So I'll wrap it up. And thanks for everybody. Thanks for the audience for listening in. If you're coming on YouTube, thanks for watching us. If you're coming on the podcast channels of your favorite podcast streaming platforms, thanks again for downloading our episode. I really appreciate it. 1,200 downloads per day. I'm so happy about this one. When I started this thing, I probably had like 2 downloads a day and I was screaming, success. This is crazy. And, you know, I really appreciate everybody listening and commenting and sharing our content. I put a lot of effort in booking the logistics of this podcast. It's only me. I don't have any support, any help. And I truly use AI to produce most of the work. But if it wasn't for that, somebody was asking me this morning, if it wasn't for AI, what do you do? I said, maybe I'll go back to the Stone Age. But, this has taught me a lot, helped me a lot. And Andre Huberger, thank you so much for joining me. I wish you all the best, you and Language Scientific, in your endeavors. And
likewise,
for somebody who is listening to this conversation, if you want to connect to Andre and you can't, or you can't find him, Andre and I, we've known each other for a while. We're connected on LinkedIn. Hit me up. I'll do the introduction for you. Happy to do that. And keep an eye for the posts, for the social post. Like, share, comment accordingly. And I'll see you at the next episode. Thanks, everybody.